know, we've got a little bit of a miscommunication and a misunderstanding, because if we look at it kind of going back to its origins, the definition high intensity, the word intensity and effort are being confused, and they are very separate things. I mean, just to kind of give you a quick example, intensity is something you should measure objectively. It's the wattage on a bike. It's the amount of pounds you're lifting. It's the, you know, the time to do your 40 seconds, 40-yard dash. Effort is just subjective. You know, if you're so physically exhausted and all you can give me is effort, well, it's not necessarily intensity. And so when we look at the origins of HIIT training, it comes out of sports conditioning. There's a simple goal, bigger, stronger, faster, which means every interval has to be done at near maximal performance.
Hi, I'm Pete McCall. Welcome to this episode of the All About Fitness podcast. That voice you heard in the beginning is a good friend and a professor of exercise science and nutrition, Fabio Camana. Fabio is a professor at San Diego State University, and on this episode of All About Fitness, Fabio joins me to talk about high-intensity interval training. It's one of the most popular forms of exercise right now, and there are some things that you're probably doing extremely well, and there are also some things that you probably might be, well, let's just say you might be needing to improve upon. Now, a little bit of information about this particular interview. This is part of my re-release series. I'm doing some summer reruns. This interview was originally recorded back in spring of 2016. It was actually one of the first interviews I recorded for the All About Fitness podcast. And Fabio, who's been a good friend, a colleague, and mentor over the years, was one of my go-tos. And as you can hear, he really does a phenomenal job of explaining the science of HIIT. Now, a little bit about this. Since we recorded this, Fabio's become one of the leading science advisors for Orange Theory Fitness. So not only does Fabio teach at San Diego State University, but he also is a leading consultant and advisor for a number of top brands, a few of whom we talk about on this interview. But he also has been a science advisor for Orange Theory Fitness, which specializes in high-intensity interval training. So Fabio really has a good background on this. On this episode, you'll hear us talk about the science of high-intensity interval training, talk about the benefits of it, and talk about the right way, the most effective way that you should be doing high-intensity interval training to get results. After a brief word from the sponsor of All About Fitness, here we go catching up with Fabio Camana, professor of exercise science at San Diego State University. It's a platform. It's a balance tool. You can do a ton of different exercises on it. Guys, you've been listening to me talk about the TerraCore. You've been hearing TerraCore ads on All About Fitness. Well, I've got great news for you. I went to the folks at TerraCore. The code AAF, I changed the code. The code AAF now gets you a 25%. That is 25% savings on a TerraCore. Use code AAF to save 25% on a TerraCore. What is TerraCore? Go to TerraCoreFitness.com. That is TerraCoreFitness.com, T-E-R-R-A, CoreFitness.com, and check out one of the coolest products in fitness. See why Men's Health voted it one of the top fitness at-home products that you should have for your workouts. Check out TerraCore Fitness on Instagram to see some amazing tricks. Again, TerraCore now is 25% off through All About Fitness. Use code AAF to save 25% on the purchase of a TerraCore. So Fabio, just to clarify, can you tell me all the different jobs that you have right now?
How much time do you have, Pete? That's maybe a better question to ask.
But I mean, I just to kind of qualify, because I know you from where I've worked with you in a number of different capacities. And so I think for the listeners to hear everything that you're a part of, I think it is pretty amazing.
Yeah. So obviously faculty at San Diego State University. I run the fitness certificate program at University of California, San Diego. I am a faculty instructor with the National Academy of Sports Medicine. And then I have my own consulting company, and I work with several different companies, one of them being CORE Health and Fitness, that you and I work with together. I am the educational director for Stroops, and I also do a lot of contractual work with private and public organizations, just kind of, you know, around the area of health and wellness.
And in a sense of full disclosure, I've known Fabio now for a number of years, and I honestly have worked with him in another capacity. We worked for the American Council on Exercise. So you've been involved with two personal training certifications, correct?
Yes, I have.
And he's been teaching at university for how long?
God, now I'm aging myself. Probably, I started as a grad student, so let's just say about 14, 15 years.
Okay, so he's been teaching. The reason why I say that is
a lot of people out there might be working with a personal trainer, and I always like to point out that there are folks out there who have been educating for personal trainers for a long time. So I really, that's why I'm glad to have you today and speaking with you, because I want to talk to you about high intensity interval training. Sure. And I like to qualify it because people have to realize that you come from a wealth of knowledge, and what their trainer might tell them might be in their best interest. And I don't think trainers mean anything wrong, but I just think sometimes they're not aware of the complete science. And that's where you really, I think one of the reasons I've enjoyed working with you is you always bring a very broad base of science to what we do in fitness. So let's talk a little about high intensity interval training. What exactly is going on with HIIT training?
Well, as you mentioned, Pete, you know, we've got a little bit of a miscommunication and a misunderstanding, because if we look at it kind of going back to its origins, the definition high intensity, the word intensity and effort are being confused, and they are very separate things. I mean, just to kind of give you a quick example, intensity is something you should measure objectively. It's the wattage on a bike, it's the amount of pounds you're lifting, it's the, you know, the time to do your 40 seconds, 40-yard dash. Effort is just subjective. You know, if you're so physically exhausted and all you can give me is effort, well, it's not necessarily intensity. And so when we look at the origins of HIIT training, it comes out of sports conditioning. There's a simple goal, bigger, stronger, faster, which means every interval has to be done at near maximal performance. So if you are not allowing yourself enough recovery and you can't provide maximal performance, not maximal effort, then you're not necessarily doing high intensity interval training. You might be doing what we call high volume interval training, which is just a high work rate. And then we'll get into that, but then it starts to beg the question, what's your goal? What's your purpose?
And I think that's a good thing to point out, because you do have a pretty strong sports performance background. And athletes in certain sports are only playing for what? They're going at max speed only in a few seconds at a time, correct? Sure. I mean, look at American football. The average play is like 3 or 4 seconds.
Yeah.
Even in rugby, where you and I both have a lot of experience, an athlete's only going to be doing high intensity for maybe 5-7 seconds at the most before a breakdown, another thing.
Sure.
And do you think that gets muddled when it gets to the general fitness
Absolutely.
Consumer?
Absolutely. So here's a quick rule of thumb. When you start understanding how the two anaerobic energy pathways work, there's a simple differentiator. If your work intervals are shorter than your recovery intervals, there's a chance that you might be doing HIIT training. But if your work intervals are longer or the same duration as your recovery intervals, and you are going beyond, say, 3 to 4 minutes, there's just no way in hell you're doing high-intensity interval training. You're doing high work rate now, because biologically, unless someone knows of a way to refute all the biology that we've known for the last 50 to 60 years, there's just no way that that is humanly possible.
And so what are the three energy pathways? I mean, what are the dominant energy pathways? How's energy created just in a short?
Sure. We have our basic aerobic and we have anaerobic. And within the anaerobic, we have, you know, kind of our most immediate, which is the phosphagen system. And it's all got to do with the location. It's what we use immediately, anytime you do anything. And the biggest misnomer a lot of people think is we only use these energy systems when we do intense work. No, it's when you need to do work. So go from sitting down to standing up. Who actually fuels that energy needed to actually transition from sit to stand is actually your anaerobic pathways. The phosphagen system at a near maximal effort is probably good for 10 seconds. Your fast glycolytic, which then takes over, is probably good in a woman for about 2, maybe 3 minutes at, you know, near maximal performance, and for a man maybe about 3 to 4 minutes. And the reason why there's a difference between men and women is because of the effects of estrogen that slows down both the anaerobic pathways.
And that's I definitely want to talk to you about that, because sure. I've heard a couple of your talks about the physiological differences, and we'll do that another time. And because I think that's something that people have to keep in mind, because I think the misperception out there is that a lot of trainers try to make it hard because people that work harder have a feeling they're burning more calories.
Yeah.
Is that true? I mean, if you're working harder, are you burning really that much more calories?
No. So, it's a bit of a myth, not a reality. I mean, of course, they'll market it as selling you more calories. They'll talk about the EPOC, you know, the afterburn. So I did a little investigative study. I did a little study with 8 athletes. And what I had them do is actually do a true HIIT workout where we first measured their maximal performance they could sustain for 60 seconds. And we were using Fit Cyclists, and we got about 320 watts average. Pretty impressive score. In the first workout, and this was done in a randomized order, in the first workout, they were asked to go at 90% or more of that wattage. So they were sustaining about 285 watts or so. You know, and then they were given 3 minutes of recovery. So the recovery was longer than the work interval. And they were recovering at 75 watts. So they were doing literally one interval every 4 minutes. And they did a 1-to-3 ratio. They did this for 20 minutes, which means they really did 5 minutes of work. And we estimated the calories, and the calories were about almost 200 calories. On the flip side of it, on workout number two, we did a 60-60. So 60 on, 60 off, 60 on, 60 off. So over the 20 minutes, they actually did 10 minutes of work. So they actually did twice as much work. But when we measured the calories, they only burned about 211 calories.
So they burned 11 calories more for
doing twice as much work. Because what happened is in the last, as we watched the work performance in the latter intervals, for example, the average of the 9th and 10th interval, they were at 42% of their peak performance. Whereas when they were taking the longer recoveries, they were still sustaining 90%. So doing more work doesn't translate to more calories. Because let's be honest, if you're sprinting, you're burning calories. If you're so tired that you have to jog, you're not burning calories. So that's the one misnomer people have to understand. It's not necessarily going to be that much of a caloric differential.
And I think that's important because I think there's this push to go hard or go home. And is that why you think HIIT training has been so popular the last few years? Is it creates that perception of doing more work?
I think there is. I think there's a lot of misconceptions, the afterburn, the epochs, which aren't there either. I think the fact that people believe because they're doing more work, they're burning more calories. But let's be honest, there's a lot of research supporting it. The time efficiency. In other words, you know, we can go back to LaForge and Tabata back in the 1990s. And it's been demonstrated, you know, ever since then that we can see improvements in health. I mean, we're seeing it from a healthy person to a stroke patient. And we're also seeing improvements in performance, like, you know, lactate thresholds, 1,500-meter run times, you know, 10K run times. These things are being achieved in a much shorter time frame. So the days of a 150 minutes a week, you know, of cardio training, it's fallen by the wayside. You can get stuff done. I mean, Timmins in England showed us 3 20-second sprints three times a week for 6 weeks. And over a period of 6 weeks, he did 18 minutes of work. Hmm. And his insulin sensitivity improved, his blood pressure improved, and his LDL cholesterol improved. So there is the time efficiency. I think that's the true scientifically validated point, is the time efficiency is there. You don't have to do as much volume of work, but it has to be intense work. And that may not be appropriate for most people.
So then, based on the research, and this is what I've seen as well, is that if I want to do really high-intensity work, I only need to do a 20, 25-minute workout.
Sure.
4 or 5 minutes of which is going to be at the highest intensity possible.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think, and you know, when I teach cycling classes, I try to get people to understand that we don't need to kill ourselves. Because what's the danger of doing too much high-intensity training? I mean, what happens physiologically if I'm doing 4 or 5 HIIT workouts a week?
Well, what we have to understand is, you know, we've heard of the word overtraining, you know, and of course the exaggerated, you know, condition of that could be something like rhabdomyolysis in weight training. But, you know, you got to think about what biologically our body is designed to do. We're designed to take stress. And every time we go into a stress response, we activate our, you know, fight or flight response. And part of what happens there is our immune system ramps itself up. It's purely for survival purposes. But the immune system is very exhausting on the body, which means after that bout of intense stress, which, again, if you think of how we're designed, it was for a short, acute, intense bout followed by a long period of recovery. And so if you are training and you're elevating your immune system and you're not giving it an opportunity to recover, and this may take a day or two, especially as we get older, you know, you talk about Generation Xers, right, which is your focal point. You know, we don't recover as quickly as we did when we were 20. So especially for that age group and even older, you know, we need that time to recover, to allow the body to return to homeostasis. And if you don't, you're just doing what? You're just driving yourself into this, you know, non-functional overreaching, which can then become overtraining, and that just leads to injury, illness, and things of that nature.
So if people are doing, you know, too many HIIT intervals a week or too many HIIT training sessions a week, are they elevating their cortisol levels? And what's the danger of that?
Cortisol in a bout of exercise being elevated is not a bad thing. But we don't live the way we're designed, because what's happening is we don't get an opportunity like our ancestors who had a fight a saber-toothed tiger, you know, eat or be eaten, kill or be killed. Then they had what? A period of 24 to 36 hours of just sitting around, you know, passively
eating saber-toothed tiger.
Oh, yeah. Or sitting around passively in the cave, right?
Yeah.
We go about our lives, which means, and you've got to understand biologically, from a biological standpoint, your body doesn't know, nor does it care, the difference between your exercise stress, which is maybe more intense and acute, versus your commute, your boss, your relationship, your finances, and your mortgage payment. And what happens is in our lives, what's becoming, you know, the demise of the human species is that we can never return our immune system back down to baseline. Because what's supposed to happen in our innate immune response is as we elevate, you know, we have this immune response, we signal the release of inflammatory proteins. And what they do is they activate our, you know, our immune system. So, you know, you talk about interleukin 6, interleukin 1, you know, necrotic factor, these types of things are designed to really do what? Help fight a stressor. But then what happens is we also activate the what's called the HPA, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal gland, and that releases cortisol. And what cortisol does, it actually goes and shuts down the immune system, because cortisol, like cortisone, is an immune suppressant. But when you start having cortisol that stays elevated continuously, it's like insulin. You start to lose that sensitivity to it. So now the immune system becomes desensitized to cortisol. So now the immune system keeps doing what? Ravaging the body and taking its toll. And then that's when we become more prone to, you know, we talk about all these people having autoimmune conditions and everything. That's part of the fact that we just don't allow our bodies an opportunity to recover.
So being overstressed at work probably means if you have a bad day or you're going, you know, through some relationship issues, you've got a lot of things going on. When you go to the gym, you probably shouldn't take it out in a high-intensity workout.
Yeah.
You're kind of just loading more stress on your body. Is that what?
Kind of. I agree that everyone thinks, well, exercise is a catharsis for me.
Yeah.
I agree 100%. But you got to look at the big picture. And I think you have been talking about this, and as I have for ages, is about recovery. How important, you know, to me, the exercise session is one thing. But when you look at your overall quality of life, the recovery is probably just as important, maybe if not more important. So we're starting to look at how do you know that your body's recovering? Well, we're starting to see technology that's helping us now, heart rate variability. And I do a manual heart rate variability. I also do what's called a control pores breathing test. And that lets you know whether you're over breathing or not. So we don't have a check engine light like a car does. And so we have to listen to our own bodies to make sure that we're not over stressing ourselves or overreaching to a point where it becomes dysfunctional. And if you are, you have to do that. You have to take that offload day. You know, maybe today you wanted to go to the gym and kick your own butt, but you know, your check engine light has said, you haven't recovered from yesterday's stress. So maybe today's a yoga. Maybe it's a mindful breathing. Maybe it's just a myofascial release day.
Maybe just to go out for a walk. Maybe call your massage therapist.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you're still exercising. I think that's the important thing. It doesn't mean don't exercise. It just means bring the intensity down. Don't overload. Don't overload the stress.
Give your body an opportunity to recover.
So then, and I think one of the reasons why HIIT is so popular is perception. It's more effective for fat burning. Let's talk a little bit about fat metabolism. What exactly? For people that are interested in exercise to burn fat, what is going to be an effective strategy? I mean, obviously HIIT can't do it all the time.
Sure.
But
well, it's interesting because the first thing you got to appreciate is, you know, there's two influences that determine how your body burns fuel. I mean, apart from genetics and those types of things. Number one, it's what you eat. If you eat a high-fat diet, you will technically elevate your level of fat utilization throughout the entire day. But we know that it's not the healthiest thing to do. The second thing is how you train. Right, because it has a spillover effect into the rest of your day. So here's the problem. When you go into high intensities, all you're really telling your body is, or teaching your body to do, is how to become more efficient at utilizing carbs. And that spills over to the rest of the day. So when you start looking at the grand scheme of things, you know, research has showed us that we have to really achieve a 2,000 calorie a week marker to lose weight. Well, exercise sessions aren't giving us that. I mean, even one of the best CrossFit workouts, Ruth, only burns 190 calories. So most people are realizing that they're not getting their 2,000 calories through the day. All right, through their workout. So we've got to, first of all, look at the grand scheme. Look at the 17 hours outside of the day. And that's been the focus of a lot of research called NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is just get off your butt and move around. So first of all, it is a calorie equation. But if you look at the calorie equation, if you're trying to cram all the calories into a compressed workout, you're going to have to do HIIT and you're just going to hurt yourself. So the idea is to be smart. Figure out how you can burn calories throughout the day. Here's the one thing I'd really drive home. Don't ask people to do more in their day. They don't have that. They don't have the inclination, nor do they have the time. Find ways to do things differently.
So it can do those little things like standing at your desk or walking around your, you know, if you skip the elevator and take the stairs. I mean, we've heard that for years.
Yeah.
Does that really make that much of a difference?
It does. Well, you know, I'm a geek, right? I'm a science geek. So I do numbers. I like to crunch numbers. And so here's the thing. The average American woman weighs 166.2 pounds. If we could get her, now that we consider the average American woman sits for 13 hours a day, all right? That's what we're getting out of the Haynes studies. Now, if we look at if I could get her to stand for 2 hours of the day, I'm not asking her to go for a walk, I'm not asking her to take the stairs, I'm just saying stand. So in other words, change what you're doing seated, doing standing. Think of your text messaging, talking on the phone, sending emails, all right? We've seen the standing workstation. If she could do that 5 days a week, 50 weeks of the year, so a standard work year, it accumulates to 10 pounds of weight, of energy. Now, that's the equivalent, if she's lucky to burn 300 calories in a session, of going to the gym almost 120 more times.
Wow. So you're just looking at the number. And the thing that always impresses me about Fabio in conversations I have is he doesn't have any notes in front of him. He's not reading from a notebook. He's not reading from a screen. He's not looking up notes. I mean, he's this whole conversation, he's been reciting research studies and use these numbers purely off the top of his head, which has always marveled me. And I think that's an important point to bring home, is doing just a little bit more each day And would you say being a little bit smarter about health nutrition choices?
Absolutely.
Is that like the real key to long-term fat loss?
That is going to be one of the key things. There's another thing that we're starting to discover now. It's really how the body burns fat. So when we look at how we've got a lot of different areas that we store fat. So let's think of the major two. One is the visceral fat. We know it's around your abdominal region, and then there's the subcutaneous fat. But we look at how hormones affect these. So obviously we know insulin is an anabolic hormone. That means it takes anything and puts it into storage, including fats. Whereas cortisol, in the right environment, is going to mobilize fat stores and theoretically make them available, right? So think of flight or fight. So what ends up happening is this, though, and this happens to favor men more than it does women. Our visceral fat is more receptive to cortisol, whereas our subcutaneous fat is less receptive to cortisol. So that means when we're in a fight or flight, we tend to mobilize from the visceral fat, all right? Which means the fat that we want to lose, which is the stuff that we see, is usually the last place we go get it.
Hmm.
On the flip side, when you're eating excess calories and you've got insulin in circulation, and what's insulin? It's an anabolic hormone. Our subcutaneous fat is more sensitive to insulin, and our visceral fat is not, which means now when we deposit fat, we're more likely to deposit in the subcutaneous regions. So we have this problem that where we want to burn fat from is generally the last place that we burn it from, and the last place we want to store it is the first place we actually store it. And this is actually worse for women, right? It's actually even further aggravated for women. But here's the catch when we talked about cortisol, going back to that topic that you made. So here I am, I'm in a fight or flight. Remember, your body doesn't know the difference. It says, hey, cortisol's up, we're mobilizing fats. So here I am mobilizing fats from, you know, all over your body, primarily your visceral tissue. And I get it over to the muscle cells, and the muscle cells go, I don't need it because we're sitting on our butt. We're just stressed. We've got a psychological stress. Well, now we have to redeposit that fat. Well, as I said, your visceral fat's more sensitive to cortisol. And so with all this elevated levels of cortisol, all that fat gets redistributed back into the visceral tissue. So
and
you may
I,
have got...
I think to stop you, I mean, I think that's a very, very important thing to bring home, because the body, the sympathetic nervous system doesn't understand the level of stress.
Sure.
It just understands getting stressed.
Absolutely.
So if somebody's sitting at their desk all day and they're on a time crunch for work, and if they're drinking, you know, too many caffeine drinks or too many high-intensity sugar drinks, are they elevating their cortisol levels?
Yeah.
Okay, and
absolutely.
So that
insulin too with all the sugar drinks, yeah.
But if they're elevating cortisol and they're releasing free fatty acids, if they're not using them, where are those free fatty acids being deposited?
Well, this is another issue we're seeing developing is with all the sugars, and I'm just going to hop on the sugar thing because this is something that we have to pay attention to too. You and I are active. I'm never worried about it. But a lot of our clients and a lot of the American public is not active. The downside is when you look at the sugar molecule, it's made up of one glucose joined to one fructose molecule.
Again, no notes here, but yeah.
Okay. So what ends up happening is during a period of exercise, glucose and fructose can both be used as fuel. So if I was eating my sugar while I'm exercising, that would be less of a problem because both those molecules could end up in my muscle cell and used as a fuel because fructose feeds into the energy pathway. But most of us eat our food, our calories, outside of exercise. So what ends up happening is glucose can go anywhere. Glucose can be deposited in any cell as glycogen or be converted to fat in any cell. It can go to your adipose tissue, can go to your subcutaneous tissue. Fructose, on the other hand, can't. Fructose only has one path. It has to go to the liver first. And in the liver, it gets converted in a perfect world to glucose. But if the body doesn't have any orders for glucose because your glycogen stores are tapped and your blood sugar is tapped, then as the body, we all know what the body will do is convert that fructose to fat. Now you got fat in the liver, so the body is faced with two choices. I either dump that fat as a triglyceride into the blood, we know that's a problem, right? Elevating triglyceride levels, or I store it in the fat. Store that fat in the liver. And what we've seen actually developing from sugar is a disease that's no different than cirrhosis. It's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease.
Wow. Okay.
And this is a disease that's plaguing children now because we're not active enough and we got so much sugar in our diets. And so we talk about fat deposition. That's another kind of sidebar to what we're talking about is that the fat in the liver, it's creating a toxic liver. And guess what? The passage of insulin normally in circulation goes through the liver into circulation. And the liver is supposed to filter out some insulin so we don't have that insulin, you know, sugar bouncing all over the place. And that helps us prevent insulin resistance. But when you develop a fatty liver, it loses its filtering capacity, which means more insulin is passing into the blood. So what we're seeing now is that fructose is actually connected to diabetes, not just glucose.
Huh.
And that's something to think about, too, in terms of where it's not just about where we deposit fat, but how fat is affecting metabolism and health in our bodies.
Well, it also gets people into thinking. They might be having a juice. They might be having something like that, thinking it's a healthier option. And that's one thing, you know, when you start reading the labels, you start seeing the calories and the sugar calories. You know, I have two young kids, and it really is, you know, I've tried not to get my kids hooked on juice for that reason, because it's basically sugar water.
Yep.
You know, and I understand that. And every now and then as a treat, it's not a bad thing. Sure. But I think we get this perception. To get back to the fat burning, I know we've talked a little bit about HIIT and other stuff. Is steady state training, like, and we've kind of gotten away from that, but is like steady state running, steady state cycling, is that an effective strategy for fat burning?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier that teaching your body how to burn fat efficiently will have that spillover. And if you're doing HIIT training, you're just teaching the body how to be an efficient fat burning machine. So you and I remember from our days at ACE, we talked about this concept called VT1, ventilatory threshold 1. And what that marker is when your ability to talk continuously is becoming challenging, not difficult. Because as you start switching from fats to carbs, you've got to focus on pushing out more air. So continuous talking becomes challenging. Now, that becomes your sweet spot. If you can train around that zone, which can be done with steady state, or it can be done with even aerobic intervals, which is Galloway, who's a running coach, popularized this with the run walk.
Yeah.
We push you into that zone where continuous talking is a little challenging, and then we might pull you back. And that becomes a little bit more enjoyable for people who say, you know, I don't want to do 45 minutes of steady state. But you're absolutely right. That intensity right there is teaching your body how to burn fats more efficiently. It may not burn many calories right now, so I always use, you may not get caloric quantity right now, but you're getting caloric quality, which means you're teaching your body how to burn fats, and that's going to spill over into your rest of your day. And then over time, it's like weight training. You go from a 10-pound dumbbell to a 15-pound dumbbell to a 20-pound dumbbell. That intensity will move itself up to a higher intensity, and you're simply moving your fat-burning marker up higher and higher into more calories, so caloric quality will ultimately move itself towards caloric quantity.
And that's one thing I've played with since we did that, and I've recommended people, I do it in my cycling classes, and I do it, you know, my own, is you'd use a talk test, and like when I go out for my own trail runs and stuff, I generally will walk the hills. And, you know, when I do, you know, mud runs and obstacle course races, I'm always amazed. I always kind of giggle because I'll fast walk and beat people who try to run because they're blowing out. They can't breathe. Yeah, and if you can't breathe, you can't get up the hill.
Absolutely.
And so I think in this HIIT world we've lived in the last few years, people have lost the appreciation for the value that steady state training brings. Now, how about weight training and circuit training? Are those effective for fat burning and kind of weight management?
No, I mean, you know, everyone talks about how high intensity stress, because again, it's a fight or flight response. So as you put your body into stress, so the higher the intensity, the greater the amount of stress. Yeah, what it does, it increases the levels of epinephrine and norepinephrine, all right? So epinephrine is our primary exercising hormone. What does that do? It mobilizes fats. So when we do high-intensity exercises, we see this research saying, wow, look at the fatty acids in the blood. They're shooting, elevating up. That means a ton of fatty acids are being dumped into the blood. Yeah, but guess what? They're not being used at the cellular level, so they're just floating into the blood until recovery. So just because you're dumping more, research shows more fats being dumped into the blood, doesn't necessarily mean we're using it. We're seeing some adaptation, but it's not anywhere near the level of which the fat's being dumped into the blood, right? So in weight training, when we go to circuit, it's like, you know, doing HIIT. The first thing that we also have to appreciate on a circuit training is a lot of people think, oh, if I just change my muscle groups, I can keep working. We have to understand that the primary anaerobic energy system, the fast glycolytic system, is not limited to the muscle. It's limited what the blood can handle. So if you're training your quads and then you go to your back and then you go to your shoulders and you go to your, you know, glutes, all you're doing is each of those is in their own exercise bout is dumping lactate and hydrogen into the blood. At some point, it's going to be the blood that's not going to be able to handle the spiller of hydrogen. That's going to shut down your circuit. So save that for another discussion. There's a whole, you know, when I do my HIIT sessions at conferences, I break down how the phosphagen system will fuel the first part of the interval and then the fast glycolytic system. But interval training, same thing. You're just dumping a tons of fats into the circulation, but your body is still burning carbs. So it's much like doing, you know, just HIIT. So what we have to do is, I'm a big fan of what I call variable modality. Go do a little bit of, you know, 4 or 5 minutes of kicking your butt, but then make sure you give yourself, switch it out. Go do some stabilization exercise, go do some core exercise, go do some stuff like that, some cardio, where you can let yourself do what, utilize those fats, and then you build that fat burning efficiency.
And I think that's, you know, I think what we're learning, what we're seeing is that the variability is key. I know I've talked about that in a little bit. You know, we tend to get in these habits of doing the same exercise, the same movements over and over and over again, especially, you know, for if I worked out years ago and I'm following the same program. So I think that variability is important to kind of play around, because it also keeps you fresh. So to finish up, what would you recommend for people interested in like weight loss, fat loss, or weight management? What would a good week of exercise look like, or a good week of activity?
You know, we have to look beyond the physiological, look at the psycho-emotional. So the first thing I would say to you is, what can you do? And, you know, don't try and force yourself to do anything else, because again, just because you did this week, it's not sustainable. So find out what it is you can do and understand this. You could probably pick up the majority of your calories by just moving around outside of your workout. So don't go into the exercise to kill yourself. And if you want to go in and do a hard workout, I give you two options. Number one, make sure you give yourself adequate recovery between one intense workout and the next intense workout. Number two, I'm a big fan, like you said, of doing some variable modalities in the workout. So instead of doing 45 minutes of this, you know, I could do, so think of this, one 30-minute cardio session versus three 10-minute cardio sessions. You're probably going to have a better experience with three 10-minute sessions, and you might be able to push yourself harder in each of those 10s than you could in any 10-minute piece of that 30-minute.
Well, just from knowing you and reading the stuff, I mean, I'll kind of do that. I'll kind of do some weight stuff, then do 5 to 10 minutes on, you know, steady state. Perfect. And just kind of keep it, because I fear I'm getting the recovery in from the weight training. And then when I go back and do more weight training, so it's like I do like 8 to 10 minute blocks of different things.
I call them micro sessions within the session. That's exactly what I do. It's called variable modality training. And generally what I try and shift, I try and shift a little bit of trying to do a little emphasis on type 2 muscle fibers. So I'd say, let's go do a hard circuit, like a 60 on, 60 on, 60 on, 60 off. But then you realize I can't keep this up for much longer because now it's going to become just a high volume workout. That's where you switch over and you go work your type 1 aerobic fibers. Give yourself the recovery. Get into your fat burning zone and then come back and do another one. So I like to undulate my workouts. But, you know, so as much as I love to do that, the question to take away, you don't have to do that every day, because like you said, on those days where you haven't given yourself recovery, go for the hike, go for the walk. You'll burn calories, you know, outside of the workout. Trust me, you take the pressure off yourself, because when you're trying to hit 2,000 calories in a week, trying to squeeze it into 3 to 4 workouts, you're just going to kill yourself in the workout. You're better off just being realistic and saying, you know, I'll get 60% of my calories outside of the workout, and that allows me to enjoy my workouts, whether it's 3 times a week, 4 times a week, or 2 times a week.
Whoa, I'm supposed to enjoy the workouts?
Well,
I think that too.
Tell me you are.
Well, that comes down to just finding out the activities. I mean, that's what one of the things I always recommend is find, what do you enjoy doing, and do more of what you enjoy. Don't force yourself to be miserable because you have this perception that, you know, some trainer one time told you that HIIT training is the only way to lose weight.
Yeah.
And I think people make that mistake. And so I appreciate your time today. I just kind of want to get through some of the mythology of training and to really get people to understand that it's not how hard you work. It's more about consistency?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we're talking about developing a consistent pattern of activities on, you know, lifestyle. So yeah, I mean, if, like you said, if you don't enjoy it, how long before you quit it? So if you find yourself being forced to do things, it's just a matter of time before you throw in the towel. I say you tolerate what you accept, all right? And if you, you know, don't enjoy these types of things, you're not going to sustain it for long. So like you said, find out what it is you enjoy. Push yourself a little bit. Don't kill yourself. Give yourself recovery. Find ways to mix things out around. And just understand it's the big picture, the other 17 hours of the day that are going to make the biggest difference. And then your nutrition. Exercise is just one piece of a big component.
Yeah, so we'll definitely have you back. I want to talk to you a bit more about the physiology and want to talk to you more about everything. And for those of you, this is Fabio Camana. And do you have a website or any information?
No, my Facebook is, I usually post a lot of stuff on my Facebook.
So yeah, it's Fabio Camana, C-O-M-A-N-A, professor of exercise physiology and exercise and nutrition sciences at San Diego State University, an educator for the National Academy of Sports Medicine, and all around good guy. So thanks for your time, Fabio.
Thanks, Pete.
Before I get into the wrap-up for the interview, I just want to take a moment to say a huge thank you to a couple of recent reviews that listeners have left for the podcast on iTunes, to Van Born and to Bernie. You guys left phenomenal reviews, and I'm overwhelmed. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm glad you're getting a lot out of the podcast, and it's exactly what I want, is to give you information that can help you enhance your quality of life. Now, the only ask I have is I'm trying not to push too much stuff, but I do have a book called Smarter Workouts, The Science of Exercise Made Simple. Now, in the book, I go through the different categories of fitness, and I mean mobility, metabolic conditioning, strength training, and I teach you simple workouts that you can do at home or in the gym using only one piece of equipment. So if you want to learn more about exercise, about fitness, the only thing I'm trying to push is my book. I go through the science of it, Smarter Workouts. You find the link below in the show notes. Now, to this discussion about high-intensity interval training, You have to understand, Fabio is a professor, so he's teaching it. He's not a research professor. He is a teacher. He's more of a, and I guess there are different categories or classifications of this. So you have people like previous guests, Martin Gabala and Dr. Len Kravitz. Martin Gabala is a PhD in Canada, McMaster University in Canada, and Len Kravitz is a PhD out of University of New Mexico. They're the ones, their labs will do the research. You know, they'll do the research, they'll do the studies, and they'll look at high-intensity interval training. Fabio will then teach on those studies in university, and Fabio will monitor students, and he'll have his students do some studies themselves, but Fabio's not submitting his studies for peer review to publications. So there's a little bit of difference there, but he's in the practical application. But the reason why I'm saying this is all these people, you know, Dr. Kravitz, Dr. Gabala, Fabio, they are very consistent in the application of the science on high-intensity interval training. And that is, when it comes to HIIT, it's the intensity. Not the amount, not the duration, not the volume, but it's the amount of intensity that really has a significant impact on the body. So it's interesting that there's a recent study. You know, Fabio and I recorded this conversation, like I said in the introduction, back in spring of 2016. And when I migrated to platforms this year, it was one of the older interviews that got lost, but it's still very relevant. A study came out, a study was published in the fall of 2018 in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. The Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research is the research journal for the National Strength and Conditioning Association. Anyway, the study was a 16-week study, so it was a relatively long study. A lot of studies are relatively short, 8 to 10 weeks. That's because they fall within a semester and the grad students need to get it done within a 14-week semester, yada, yada, yada. So a lot of studies are only for 8 to 10 weeks. When you look at longer studies that last upwards of 16 weeks, you get a little better idea of how exercise can impact the body, but you're only doing it from a very small population. However, anyway, this one study, it compared high-intensity interval training to steady-state training. And in this study, the study participants, you had three groups of people. You had the control group that did nothing. So you always have a control group that does nothing because they want to test and retest and see if they made any changes at all. That's just always a control group. One study group in this study did three 30-minute workouts on a treadmill throughout the study. So over the course of 16 weeks, one study group was doing three 30-minute runs on a treadmill at about 80% of their max VO2. And so the study, you know, they would adjust the intensity up when they needed to, but the one study group did 90 minutes of workouts a week. They did three 30-minute treadmill sessions at 80% of VO2. Now, the other study group, they did three workouts a week, but they're only four-minute high-intensity interval workouts. So the other study group did a four-minute Tabata. A Tabata is 20 seconds of really intense exercise, followed by 10 seconds just long enough to catch your breath, and repeat that for 4 minutes. So one study group did 12 minutes of exercise a week. They did three Tabata workouts a week. The other group did three 30-minute treadmill runs a week. So you have 12 minutes of exercise versus 90 minutes of exercise. Who do you think saw better results? That's right, the 12 minutes. The people who did three 4-minute Tabata workouts at a very high intensity, at their hardest intensity, hardest level of effort possible, got better results than people who did three 30-minute treadmill workouts a week. That's the significance of intensity versus duration. If you do the right intensity, you don't need to spend a lot of time in the gym. And I've been playing around with this for myself and for clients. And honestly, 4 to 8 minutes on a piece of cardio equipment, if you're doing the right type of interval training, 4 to 8 minutes is all you really need to do. If you're doing 20 to 30 second intervals at maximal effort, maximal intensity, meaning you are pushing your hardest and you cannot go for 30 second or 33rd second, that means you're doing the right intensity. You know, but if you're doing 30 seconds and yeah, okay, at the end of 30 seconds, you still have some gas in the tank, you got to increase it, because HIIT training is all about the intensity. And what we're seeing, what the data is showing, is that less is more. You know, now Fabio helped write the HIIT program, the high intensity interval training program that I currently teach for Stairmaster. So that's one of the things that we worked on together. And that's what we're trying to do with Stairmaster products, is we're trying to get people to understand that if you push the intensity, you don't need to kill yourself with duration. Now, if you're over the age of 35 and you're like, I love HIIT workouts, but sometimes I feel like I'm dragging, sometimes I feel like I can't push through. Now, keep in mind that the other side of HIIT, you know, high intensity, obviously, we talk about this a little bit. The other side is recovery. If you're over the age of 35, it's going to take you longer to recover from a HIIT workout. I don't care what you say. It's based on age, based on nutrition, based on sleep. But if you're over the age of 35, try to limit your HIIT workouts to three a week or less. So if you're over the age of 35, that means 3 HIIT workouts a week or less. Less than 3 HIIT workouts a week. If you're getting great sleep, if you're getting great hydration, if you have great nutrition, you can push 3, maybe 4 HIIT workouts a week. But for most people, I'd really recommend only 2 really hard HIIT workouts a week. And then the other workouts can be relatively moderate intensity. But that's just based on the best information. And they don't need to be an hour-long HIIT workout. 6 minutes, 8 minutes, 10 minutes is all you need if you're doing the right intensity. That's the information I'm trying to bring you today. This is a great interview. I did not want to lose it to the dustbins of history. So I wanted to pull it up and re-release Fabio. And he really is, hands down, one of the smartest guys. I'm recording this actually at the end of August, actually early September 2019. And I took a little break here because it was actually Fabio who set up the trip. I went to India and spoke at a conference in India for a few days. And Fabio's been doing a great job of networking with different fitness schools around the world. And he's been one of the reasons why I've been traveling all around the world helping to teach. So Fabio, thank you for that. Thank you for including me the trip to India. But in this trip, we went to India. We spoke at a conference in Delhi for a few days. And then from there, I went to Shanghai, China, where I spoke at an event in China. And you can go back and listen to one of the previous episodes of All About Fitness, where I discuss what fitness is like in China and how fitness is evolving in the international market. Thanks for stopping by. I'm Pete McCall. You can follow me on Pete_fitness on Instagram. That's Pete_fitness on Instagram. I always put exercise tips up there. Thank you for stopping by, and I hope to see you again, or hope to have you stop by again for future episodes of All About Fitness.